This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
Your mind lies in the devil's workshop.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is Holy Thursday on the Christian calendar. In accordance with biblical gospels, it is a day to commemorate the Last Supper Jesus shared with his apostles before crucifixion. For the faithful, Jesus' suffering, death, and resurrection provide a path to atonement and salvation for humanity. As the theology evolved, so did the notion of being saved as an escape from the fiery furnaces of hell. Today, hell is a long commute, other people a scary threat to behave, an expletive or a metaphor that many contemporary theologians do not even believe exists. Candida Moss is a professor of theology at Notre Dame University. She pondered the nature of hell for the Daily Beast. And Dr. Candida Moss, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for not having me.
When does this notion of hell first appear in history?
Well, hell develops very gradually. So originally when people died, they were buried in the ground. And so that space under the ground was sort of this shadowy realm. But it was a place that everyone went to. It wasn't specifically bad people. But over time, and in about the second century BC, under influence from emerging Babylonian traditions and the ancient Greeks, people began to think of Hades as a bad place, a place with fire, a place of torment and punishment for the wicked. And over the course of the next 2,000 years, the details of those tortures and those punishments got really excruciating, and hell just got sort of bigger and more detailed.
How about for the other religions of the book, for the Hebrew Bible, for example, or for Islam? Are there notions of heaven and hell?
Yeah, there are definitely notions of heaven and hell in both Judaism and in Islam. What's interesting is that in Judaism, the reason why people began to think about eternal torment was because they were oppressed by foreign regimes. And initially they thought, if we're good, God will vindicate us and free us from the Greeks who were oppressing us. And when that didn't happen, they began to put the idea of reward and punishment further in the future. So at some point in the distant future, the world will end, and then there'll be a final sorting period, and the good people will go to heaven and the bad people will go to hell. And that notion of hell was actually really important. It was important that the bad people who mistreated you now would one day see that they were wrong, and they would see that you were right, and they would be punished for the bad things they had done to you.
How about in Islam? We, of course, have the image of paradise. How about hell?
Yeah, there are notions of torment and punishment in Islam as well. There's a lot of exchange between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, particularly in the 6th through 10th centuries. And Islam flourished in a region that had been really influenced by Babylonian traditions and Zoroastrianism, which was also very keen on hell. And a lot of those traditions came into Islam as well.
Let's go back then to the early Christians, where hell becomes a place where those deserving punishment go and suffer eternal torment. When did the eternal torment idea come into it?
Well, you can see it sort of in nuggets in the New Testament. So in the book of Revelation, there's a lake of fire into which death and Satan and the sinners are thrown. And it's unclear if that's forever or if you sort of get consumed in the fire and then that's it for you. But in the centuries following, Christians began to develop sort of tours of hell where they would talk about what happens to adulterers or what happens to liars or what happens to people who oppress the poor or even people who don't pay attention in in church, and there are these really detailed, painful torments that happen to you, even if you're just not paying attention in church.
They are unbelievably detailed. Can you paint a picture of some of that which inspired so much fear within people?
Yeah, so the punishment for adultery or for premarital relations for women was to be strung up by your hair, held by your hair, and then sort of submerged in sort of this filthy, mucky mire, they call it. For some of the other punishments, you would have rocks thrown at you by angels, or you'd be immersed in flames of fire up to your neck. For women who had exposed their infants, they would be submerged, and then their infants would shoot bolts of lightning at them out of their eyes, which is just a terrifying image to even just contemplate. And then there are other regions of sort of big pits where people are thrown into and sort of hooks that are used to suspend people. It's pretty detailed and gruesome.
And they became much more specific as Christianity began gathering steam. What's the relationship there, do you think?
Yeah, as Christianity starts to think more and more about how do we get people to be good, they start to devise more specific tortures. One of the reasons for this is just the technology of torture was developing during the period. One of the other reasons was that the tortures correlate to the sin. So the reason why women are suspended by their hair is because hair was sort of a thing of beauty in the ancient world, and women's hair was sort of very seductive. So it would be the thing that had allowed you to sin, your beautiful hair, was now being used to punish you. So there's sort of a correlation between the sin and the punishment in that way. And one of the reasons for that was just to instruct people. Today, when we think about how do you teach your children to be good, we no longer use physical punishment. We try not to threaten them. But in the ancient world, they thought that this was how you school your children. You would beat them and you would scare them. And so these stories are about scaring people. And even though it doesn't mean a lot to us because it seems so barbaric, it was a way of getting people to behave correctly.
Mm-hmm. So it becomes this tool for behavior. And we see that in Europe, you know, the images of the damned over the lintels of these early Christian and medieval churches. But that notion of the cruel, judgmental Old Testament God that would send you to the fiery furnace, how does that work today when a more loving Christian theology dominates and is much more popular?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's and that sort of idea of could you really punish someone forever and ever? How could that be ethical? That's one of the reasons that many modern theologians now disavow hell entirely. And if they do believe in hell, they talk about hell as a place where God isn't present. So you're cut off from God's presence, and that's going to be punishment enough. There's going to be, you know, fire or tortures or devils hurting you. For some people, even that is too difficult. They think, well, could a just God really do that? But there are still certain branches of Christianity that feel very strongly that hell does exist, and that if you deny hell, not only are you going there yourself, but you could lead other people there too.
How so?
Well, so for example, the very famous pastor Rob Bell, who has a TV show now, he was disavowed by other evangelicals for saying, look, I just can't get on board with hell. It just doesn't seem good to me. And a lot of people sort of expelled him from their communities and pushed him out. Things have turned out all right for Rob Bell, but the reason they did that was they thought, well, if he tells people there isn't a hell, then they're not going to believe in something really important. And if there is a hell, it's important that people know because they'll behave correctly in order to avoid it. So the idea is if you deny hell and teach other people not to believe in hell, perhaps they'll start just doing whatever they want.
We're talking about evolving notions of hell with Dr. Candida Moss. She's a professor of theology at Notre Dame University who specializes in the study of martyrdom in the early Christian church. Some contemporary Christians even say that the traditional visions of hell have suppressed the truth of the all-loving God. Are they opposing images of hell and God?
Yeah, this is one of the questions. How could you have an all-loving God who could possibly allow something like hell to continue to exist? Some people have said, well, it's about justice. If you sin against God, you deserve to be punished. And in the historical context in which that idea emerged, that made sense because it was the medieval period and they were very acutely focused on justice and punishment like this. There is a tension here, an undeniable tension between an all-loving deity and eternal punishment. And I think one way to get around this is to look at what's the purpose of hell? When people dreamed this up, what were they using it for? And they were using it for instruction. Now, it doesn't really serve that purpose in the modern world because this isn't how we teach people anymore. So I think it is worth saying, if this isn't a good tool for instructing people, should we really have it? Should we really talk about it, especially when it's at odds with the idea of a loving deity?
I also would imagine that the demise of this concept of hell or the erosion of this concept of hell happens while the state is rising. The state is policing you. The state is making sure that you behave.
Yeah, to an extent, although often before the modern period, the state would also harness this idea of hell in order to punish people. So when heretics were burned under the auspices of the church, but also by political regimes in early modern Europe, they would say, well, burning you at the stake now in the hopes that you avoid the torments of the flames of hell. So we're doing you a favor by setting you on fire now. So it works both ways. On the one hand, the state assumes responsibility for punishment, but in certain contexts, the state has been able to harness the idea of hell to do some pretty barbaric things.
You mentioned the outlier theologians, some of whom have embraced a more loving vision of God, less of hell as a place. How do you think it's evolving in our all-over culture, this notion or concept of hell?
Well, I think today, because people have a different sort of understanding of geology, people don't think of hell as a space that's down, that's very hot, that you go to when you die underneath the ground. So I think that's fallen away. And I think now when people look around the world, they see enough injustice and violence and horror in our modern world that hell is now more something that we can see around us that affects people's lives that we could potentially try and change. So I think just in the sort of metaphorical vocabulary of hell, hell is now being applied to situations of injustice, and this is probably a good thing, people are trying to fix that.
Dr. Candida Moss, Professor of Theology at Notre Dame, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You can read Candida Moss's full article on the purpose of hell at wordofmouthradio.org.
Hit it! To hell! To hell!
Coming up, hell comes in many forms, for some in the form of a patent troll. When Word of Mouth continues, a story of patents, dentures, and a murder. Stick around for that story when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we talked about how the concept of hell has changed through the centuries, from molten pits of unfortunate souls to something more abstract. Today, there are at least a few people out there who might argue that hell is a patent troll. You might be surprised to know that patent trolls have been around for a long time. And in this next story, Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible discovers that they were just as unpopular in the 19th century as they are today.
As horrible and litigious as patent enforcement and infringement are today, it rarely results in murder.
Murder, sir?
But things were different in 1879. That's when a hounded and pursued patent violator struck back and made it possible for average working people to afford quality dentures.
It's a very historically significant murder. I mean, anyone who ever gets dentures is indirectly affected by this crime.
That's John Marr.
My name's John Marr. I'm the editor and publisher of the fanzine Murder Can Be Fun.
Before the 1850s, dentures were made out of very hard, very painful, and very expensive material, like gold or ivory. They were a luxury item. But the invention of vulcanite hard rubber changed everything. It was moldable, it could be precisely fitted, and it was relatively cheap. Everyone began making dentures with vulcanite.
And these dentures had been overwhelmingly popular.
But then in 1864, a long-disputed patent application, originally filed a dozen years earlier in 1852, was awarded and then acquired by the Goodyear Dental Vulcanite Company. It was a company created to collect fees or, very often, sue dentists who already used vulcanite. And there were plenty of dentists to go after. And the person that went after them was named Josiah Bacon, the treasurer of the Goodyear Dental Vulcanite Company.
And the Vulcanite Company was trying to collect, and Josiah Bacon was trying to personally collect, royalties from their patent from the dentists.
The Goodyear Vulcanite Company now monopolized the market. Dentists were required to buy their rubber and other contraptions used to make denture bases from them, and there were heavy taxes and fees associated with all of this. The price just kept going up and up.
Josiah Bacon was crisscrossing the country, throwing dentists in jail, extracting fees, fines, setting up sting operations. He was a very busy man, very enthusiastic about enforcing his patent.
It was reported and disputed that Bacon's zeal for enforcing the patent may have been more his personal mission than that of the Goodyear Vulcanite Company.
He had rigged the deal, so he actually personally got the money. I don't know how much the details, but it sounds like a very unusual financial arrangement with the company.
Enter Samuel Chalfant, a dentist who made dentures and who didn't pay the Goodyear Vulcanite Company for the privilege.
And Josiah Bacon was out to make an example of him. Josiah Bacon had chased Chalfant out of Delaware, out of St. Louis, and finally in San Francisco. And he was swearing he was going to send him to prison.
Samuel Chalfant was completely beaten down by this relentless pursuit and claimed that he went to Josiah Bacon's San Francisco hotel room on Easter Sunday, 1879, to make peace, to pay whatever he could, and just go back to being a simple dentist.
However, Chalfant, he had a gun in his pocket. And as he says, he argued with Bacon. Bacon threatened to send him to prison. To command some respect, Chalfant pulled the gun, and as guns that you wave in front of your enemies always do, it went off.
Samuel Chalfant murdered Josiah Bacon.
Chalfant was like extremely upset. He sat in the hotel suite waiting for people to come in to capture him. Everyone was down at breakfast, so he slipped out of the hotel. And he wandered around the city and took a room in a cheap rooming house and just kind of laid in bed for a couple days, you know, guilty, feverish, distraught. And then he turned himself into the police. He made a statement to the police where he said that he had shot Bacon accidentally.
And the police believed he was sincere, thinking that he'd have to come up with some story better than that if it was truly premeditated.
However, when it came time for a trial, the prosecution had this man marching in the hotel room of his bitterest enemy with a loaded gun in his pocket.
The consensus was he was very lucky to get off with a 10-year sentence for second-degree murder.
He actually had a very good gig in prison. He was the prison dentist. He had an office outside the walls. Or actually, most importantly, he didn't have to work in the jute mill making burlap sacks like most of the other poor guys did. The only part of the prison uniform he had to wear were striped trousers. His patients who weren't convicts, he could collect fees from. For being in San Quentin, he had it pretty good, but nonetheless, he just found it enormously oppressive and, you know, was quoted as saying that he would almost have preferred to have gone to the gallows than to just be locked up in a cell for 15 hours out of 24.
Chalfant had a female admirer on the outside, fighting for his release by normal legal means. But it was alleged that she also tried to get him out of prison through less than legal means.
Someone slipped him some, non-striped trousers, a railroad ticket, some money, and some pistols in a bag of laundry, and he snuck out with a crowd of visitors taking the boat back to the city. And before they noticed he was gone, he was safely ensconced on a Utah-bound train. The only reason he was caught, he had disguised himself with some whiskers, but he was eating a peach while they were crossing Nevada, and the juice from the peach loosened the gum holding his whiskers enough that a rail detective spotted that this guy looked kind of suspicious.
He was detained in Nevada.
He never made it past Winnemucca.
Even though he got caught escaping, he was later pardoned and only spent 6 years in prison when he got out.
He returned to San Francisco and was a very successful dentist until he retired shortly before the earthquake.
But it must have felt kind of weird making vulcanite dentures.
In doing my research, I found a directory of professional men of San Francisco from the 1890s. And there was a half page in there on him, and it talks about his education, his experience in serving the Civil War. But it makes absolutely no mention of rubber dentures, Josiah Bacon, or the Vulcanite Company.
But this extreme case of anti-patent troll vigilantism, or cold-blooded murder, however you want to view it, did have an effect. The Goodyear Vulcanite Company stopped enforcing their patent.
Apparently, none of their employees was really willing to take a chance of being shot by a dentist. And there's also the implication that sort of this whole denture patent was kind of a Josiah Bacon's personal project more than it was major policy of the company's.
And the patent lapsed. Most of the world forgot about Samuel Chalfant, but the late 19th century dental profession learned from their bitter experience in what they considered the vulcanite rubber patent reign of terror. They collectively positioned themselves so that they could no longer be milked by any profiteering patent holders. Many years later, a similar scheme was put into motion to try to collect royalties for gold crowns, and the Dental Association killed it easily, without firing a single shot.
And that was Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible. Coming up after the break, comedian Eugene Merman talks about majoring in stand-up comedy in college and going to summer camp in New Hampshire.
I think I was in the maybe wolf clan, I can't remember, maybe bear.
I'll talk with Eugene Merman when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. While you may not immediately recognize his face, you may recognize Eugene Merman's voice as Gene on Fox's animated series Bob's Burgers.
Do you see a lion or a witch or a wardrobe?
A what?
A lion, a witch, or a wardrobe!
Why are you saying that, Gene?
It's a book!
Oh, right, right. A kid's book, yeah.
Yeah, by Salman Rushdie.
It's not by Salman Rushdie.
Of course it is!
It isn't.
Yes, it is!
I'm not gonna talk to you anymore, Gene. I'm in a wall. Go look it up, though.
I just did. It's Salman Rushdie.
Aside from his voiceover work, Eugene Merman had a recurring role in HBO's Flight of the Conchords, played a bumbling Russian mobster on the Adult Swim series Delocated, and is a seasoned stand-up comedian, where his stage work often combines storytelling with a touch of the absurd.
I hit a guy on a bike with a door. Of a car, not like a door I carry around and be like, stop saving the earth. By accident. I opened the door of my cab and it hit this guy and he started screaming at me and he's like, look where you're going, you broke the law. And I'm like, look where you're going. And we're just sort of yelling and I look down and I see a bike lane. And as he's screaming at me, I look at him and I go, sorry, I was wrong. He was so mad. He was like, no big deal. He had to go home and be like, I met this really nice guy who hit me with a door. It just made me want to cut people off in traffic just to apologize and be like, sorry, that was my fault.
And you can see Eugene Merman for yourself this Friday at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth. Eugene Merman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, you've been performing stand-up for about 20 years, and you're just 40 years old. So was comedy a plan from a young age?
It was, yeah. I always sort of loved stand-up, and I think at some point it occurred to me that it was a career that you could do. And so I started doing stand-up, and I did it in college, and then after college, and still today.
Well, it's pretty bold considering your background. I mean, your family emigrated from the U.S. To the U.S. from Moscow in 1978. You were just four. This was, of course, during the Cold War, waning years, but still. The KGB had targeted your parents and tapped your phone. So I'm just curious about how your parents reacted when you said, I'd like to be a comedian.
Well, you know, they were actually incredibly supportive. I think potentially much more so than, you know, other immigrant families might have been. But I think to them, they legitimately wanted to bring my brother and I here to America where we could, you know, do what we want and not be as watched by the government. Watched like a little, but barely.
Do you remember moving to the U.S.? Do you have early memories of
I don't
that?
Really. I mean, I remember not fitting in, but I don't really remember the move.
Well, what do you mean not fitting in?
I mean, growing up in the 80s during the Cold War and being from Russia. So people thought I was a spy. Admittedly, those were other third graders. But, you know, it still created hardship.
I can imagine. Do you think that being that outsider, though, may have been what led you to comedy? I mean, you're coping
yes.
on some level.
I do. I think like sort of being, partially an outsider and then also sort of an insider in terms of growing up within the culture. I do think it gave me a sort of interesting perspective. And I think that does, you know, probably affect how I see things and how I see the world and also comedy.
How did your classmates take it? I read something about your first comedy routine in sixth grade. You want to talk?
Oh, I don't think that was a comedy routine. I think I just lip sync Bill Cosby's stand up, which is not how you do a book report. And so then I went into special ed.
Really? They put you in special ed for that?
I don't think it was for that. I think it was for, I think that was the catalyst. But I think everything in terms of me being a terrible student and a lot of other stuff was part of it.
Wow. So that must have really cemented, you know, in those terms, in the middle school terms, a kind of weirdo status.
Yes. Yeah, that and being foreign and all of it. I mean, every year it sort of contributed to the next. And it was probably only in high school that things got a little better in that way. But my first actual stand-up was sort of the summer after high school and then once at a talent show in high school.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what you did for a routine then?
A little bit, yeah. I had a joke. I think the first joke I ever wrote was, what profession do you think has the highest suicide rate? A lot of people think it's dentists, but it's actually kamikaze pilots.
That's funny.
It's pretty good. Delivered even by an incredibly anxious 18-year-old, it was not terrible.
Well, you know, despite your track record with book reports, you did get into Hampshire College and created your own major, which was comedy. How did that work?
Well, Hampshire in general, you create your own major. So the fact that I created comedy is not unusual sort of to the fact that everyone creates their own major. But, it worked out great because a lot of people I knew went to liberal arts schools and, majored in history or English or writing or whatever it is that they wanted to do. So I did sort of just an offshoot of that. I just made it much more specific and then did a 1-hour stand-up act that I, you know, wrote and promoted and produced and performed. And I actually learned a lot from that experience. So it was sort of almost like going to an artistic trade school in certain ways.
Wow. So you did stand-up sort of like as your final exam or thesis?
Yeah, I did a 1-hour stand-up show as my at Hampshire, it's called Div 3, but basically as a thesis.
Wow. Well, you later went back to Hampshire as a commencement speaker. This was in 2012. Let's hear just a clip.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor, especially considering I barely got into Hampshire. It was in special ed from 6th to 12th grade. Still, thank you, even though I know some of you were hoping the speaker would be Chairman Mao. He is dead and charges an exorbitant personal appearance fee for a communist.
When you graduated, did you know what kind of comedy you wanted to do?
No. I mean, I ran a comedy show, a weekly comedy show in the basement of my dorm, and I would also go to Boston and New York to do sets. But basically, I would try something on stage, and if it got people to laugh, it would become kind of part of my act. And then if it didn't, I would either, you know, try to change it or get rid of it. And it's almost sort of like a slightly trial and error scientific method, which I guess is how all comedy works. But, I think it just sort of developed naturally as you would perform and then keep what worked and then get rid of what didn't. Mm-hmm.
We're speaking with the stand-up comedian, comic actor, and founder of the Eugene Merman Comedy Festival, Eugene Merman. He's going to be at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth this Friday. But your career has not followed the typical trajectory of a stand-up comedian. You've done a lot of voiceover work, you know, started the Eugene Merman Comedy Festival, which is going to be in Boston and Cambridge this month. work with Neil deGrasse Tyson's Star Talk radio show, created a number of petitions to the White House, and this online store, Flotsam. Where do these all come from?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is that I like working on different projects with different friends. So, it's true that it's very much not a traditional path to stand up or to I guess a career of any kind. But each thing on its own made sense, and I think a lot of it actually extended from, you know, when I was at Hampshire, because to do a 1-hour stand up show for a lot of people, you have to figure out how to get people to show up, and there's so much that you have to do to get there, and that you're just basically constantly problem solving these sort of problems that you're creating. And figuring out how to have it work out. So I think a lot of the different stuff I do is sort of, you know, John Benjamin had this idea for a mystery sack, and then we kind of figured out how to, you know, work with another friend of ours and sort of get a business off the ground.
Well, I highly recommend that listeners go and take a look at Flotsam. We do have a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. But Eugene, I can't help thinking that this is beginning to sound like an endorsement for Hampshire College.
I really enjoyed Hampshire. I thought it was great, you know, but so much of the technology and stuff that exists now, you know, when I was in college, the idea of having a video camera was such a luxury, and even a computer. And now the idea that you couldn't make a feature film on your own with a telephone is absurd. So things have changed so much, and so much control is in people's own hands, except for now there's so much content that it's extremely hard to sift through and have anyone pay attention. But you know, everything's a solvable problem, I think.
Well, your parents were supportive when you said you wanted to be a comedian. You just talked about how different the road would be for a young comedian. Is it a viable career for young people today between comedy podcasts, the internet, television? Is there a lot more room for weirdos than when you were growing up?
There's much more room for a lot of niche stuff. You know, you can be... If you can figure out how to sell to 100,000 fans, you don't need to be on television, or you don't need anything in particular. But everything is still something you have to figure out. I don't know. I mean, I would never tell anyone. Like, it'd be really funny to go, like, don't become a writer. We're all set. Like, who would you ever tell that to? Hopefully not a very good writer. I definitely think if you want to be a comedian, you have to move to probably... You have to do it somewhere for like 5 years and then move to New York or L.A.
Yeah, so not in New Hampshire?
You can be. Well, you can. It just depends. I mean, you can make up probably a popular radio show or podcast or whatever from anywhere. But I think that if you want to be sort of a stand-up, you can then do that and then move back. I know lots of people who moved to New York for 10 years and then, you know, moved to either where they were from or somewhere else.
As long as they have a good airport near them, right?
I think as long as you have a pretty good airport, if you want to do stand-up, yeah.
Well, this is not going to be your first time in New Hampshire when you're at 3S Art Space on Friday. Can you tell us about going to camp, summer camp in New Hampshire?
Camp to Commupog?
I'm really glad you said it.
Yes. It was a camp that I went to as a kid in, I think, East Madison. It was a nice time at a camp. I think I was in the maybe Wolf Clan. I can't remember. Maybe Bear.
I guess it sounds like summer camp.
Yeah, summer camp with maybe a bonfire and some loincloth.
Yes, there's always that sort of pseudo Native American thing at summer camp. What's that about?
I don't know. It's your state.
Well, Eugene Rerman.
I came from Russia, and then people were like, "Here, put this on and dance around." And I was like, "Okay, I just want to fit in."
Well, I'm so glad you're returning to New Hampshire. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Eugene Merman, he's a writer, stand-up comedian, the voice of Gene on Bob's Burgers, and creator of the Eugene Merman Comedy Festival, which is coming up in Boston from April 17th to 19th. But this weekend, he will be at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth. There are details at wordofmouthradio.org. And now on to another comedian, one who made headlines this week. On Monday, there was a roar of approval when The Daily Show announced that Trevor Noah would succeed Jon Stewart as host. But the love fest quickly soured when a few questionable tweets that Noah sent over the past 5 years were rounded up and circulated on the web. Author John Ronson writes about the phenomenon of online shaming in his new book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. We caught up with him and asked him what he makes of the Trevor Noah scandal.
You know, he's straight out of the people in my book, because here's somebody who wrote 9,000 funny, innocuous, you know, fine tweets, 5 offensive tweets, and people have kind of combed through his Twitter feed, found these 5 tweets, and are using them as evidence of his kind of inherent wickedness or worthlessness. Like we're all amateur detectives, you know, looking for these clues as to what's going on inside people's heads. And, you know, it's not true about human beings. We can't and shouldn't be defined by the worst tweet we ever wrote, because we know that human beings, you know, on Twitter we've created this very damaging and very real and destructive, like, stage for constant artificial high dramas. Everybody's either a magnificent hero or a sickening villain. So Trevor Noah went from being a magnificent hero to a sickening villain in a couple of hours. And that is untenable, because it's not only affecting people like Trevor Noah, it's affecting all of us. It's affecting our children, who are all being shamed on social media now because of this, you know, weird surveillance milieu we've created for ourselves.
Has that had a chilling effect for you? Before you send a tweet, do you have to think about it twice now, that something will be revealed or something will be offensive?
Yeah. And I really hate that about myself. It's and I don't want my book to be like, you know, lots of people have said to me, I'm sending this book to my children because I want them to think twice next time they write a tweet that may be misconstrued. You know, I don't want that, because that's kind of victim blaming. But yes, I've fallen victim to that too. I'm more conformist and bland now, but I do not want that to be the world we live in. Mm.
Well, we've created a kind of payoff, though, for the Slates or the Salons or the other media organizations. Let's say Gawker is a prime example of going through and finding something shameworthy about us. Yeah. So there's something behind that. Obviously, there's a reward for those of us who are witnesses.
Yeah, and it's partly a kind of moral reward, because we want to imagine ourselves to be kind of good, upstanding people, punching up, you know, attacking privilege. There's also a reward in that people are congratulated for this, and, you know, people want to solve puzzles and solve mysteries. But, you know, we are sleepwalking into creating a surveillance culture, and that's going to be bad for all of us in the end. You know, I rather like the system in some countries where it's like, you know, okay, that was an idiotic thing to do, but I understand that you were a fully rounded and dimensional human being. And, you know, that's something that Monica Lewinsky said in a TED Talk this week. You know, people forget that I am dimensional and there was a time when I wasn't broken. Hmm. And, you know, that sentence came from years of her thought. And there's similar sentences in my book that come from, like, years of my thought. You know, we've really ended up going down the same road together, me and her.
John Ronson, I want to thank you.
Thank you.
John Ronson's new book is So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and he's also the author of The Men Who Stare at Goats and The Psychopath Test. We would love to hear from you on this issue. Do you think Trevor Noah should be taken to task for his Twitter jokes, or has online shaming just gone too far? You can join the conversation, where else, on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Around for more Word of Mouth. Up next, we're going to tackle an uncomfortable reality for people pursuing a career in science. Diversity, the emotional cost of crossing the color barrier, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. STEM stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. And discussions about expanding educational and career opportunities in STEM fields often go hand in hand with encouraging women and people of color to fill those roles. But doing so can be harder and more emotionally fraught than you might expect. Reporter Ari Daniel has a profile of one man working hard to make it.
I recently met a man who tends to stick out, and not always for the reason he'd like. Here's an example. The year was 1991, and John DeMangia, a graduate student in chemistry at the time, had been invited to give a talk at a conference in Anaheim, California.
In the evening, we had a speaker's cocktail hour, and another person who was there said, I'll have a Chardonnay. And I turned to look at him because I was like, are you talking to me? And he's like, well, I mean, chop, chop.
Demanja thought he may have been the first black person this man had ever seen at a speaker's cocktail hour.
Now, the person who had invited us, he overheard. And so he came and he said, he's one of our guests. And so I was as frustrated at the person who just assumed that because I was black, I was there to serve. But I was also frustrated at the chair who had invited us for feeling the need to protect me.
When this kind of thing happens to Demanja, when he's singled out as the only black man at a professional gathering, he usually shrugs it off. Take that guy who asked him for the Chardonnay.
Should I be mad at him? Maybe not. Because his truth, up to that point, needed to be challenged. And so I can't be mad at him for having a truth that has evolved. And if I know that I belong there, then I'm not offended.
Demanja's capacity for handling situations like this goes back to his childhood. When he was 6, his family moved from Ohio to the Congo. That's where his parents had grown up, and they were bringing the family home.
My only saving grace was that my parents had taught me the language. I remember meeting cousins for the first time, and they greeted us very politely in English. And then we said a few words in the native tongue, and it was night and day. Then they could really say what they wanted to say. So communicating in the language of the area, it opens doors that otherwise would not be open.
As Demanja grew up, he studied chemistry in the Congo, Belgium, and the U.S., and it was chemistry that became his new language, the key to opening a new set of doors, like becoming a graduate student at Southern Illinois University. One of Demanja's first tasks was TAing a general chemistry course.
I walked into class, and I could immediately see that we're not used to this. But I spoke the language of chemistry, and I spoke it well. Within the first 10 minutes of class, they were treating me like they would treat anybody else.
But you're not, are you annoyed at all that you have to prove that?
No, because unless I talk to them and I see where it's coming from, it's not their fault. You know, we are all prejudiced.
After earning his PhD, Demanja eventually ended up in Atlanta at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where he became one of the world's experts on a technique called 2D gas chromatography. It's a way of taking a complex mixture and pulling it apart into all its various chemical ingredients.
Gas chromatography is how all the urine tests for doping in the Olympics is done.
Demanja also analyzed urine samples from the firefighters involved in the World Trade Center recovery efforts after 9/11. If the levels of certain carcinogens were too high, they were advised to halt work until the compounds flushed from their bodies. It was rewarding for Demanja, but eventually he wanted a change, which is what brought him to Spelman, a historically black college. Demanja wanted to influence black students.
In the 12 years that he's been here, I would say he's doing much more than persons in a 30-year career.
Albert N. Thompson Jr. is a chemist, and he's chair of the science and math division at Spelman. He was thrilled, both when the college recruited Demanja.
We thought ourselves to be very fortunate.
And when Demanja joined in recruiting more female students of color into majors and careers in the hard sciences through active, caring mentorship.
African Americans, somehow they get discouraged during the K-12 level. You know, when you stereotype people very early because of their color, you just never know what you're missing out on. You have to have diverse views.
Which may mean breaking a barrier or two, says John Demanja.
We know of many brilliant black chemists, but there has not been a black Nobel Prize winner.
How is that going to change in science?
By folks like me coming here and increasing the number of black scientists.
And Demanja adds that all people, regardless of color, can do science and be successful at it.
That's the more powerful story that I would like to project out there.
In other words, you are an accomplished scientist.
First and foremost. And that's really the only way I want to be looked at.
Our series, Small Matters, is produced by the Center for Chemical Evolution and sponsored by the National Science Foundation, with additional support from NASA. I'm Ari Daniel.
Thank you so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.